You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Oh, how about now?
Oh.
Okay. So my name is Vanessa Williamson. I'm a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And I'm very excited to be here today to share the results of the Filer Voter Program, which is a field experiment testing a very simple idea. What if, when people were filing their income tax returns, we asked them if they would like to register to vote? And I'm thrilled to be able to share the results of that experiment today. And I'm, if it's actually possible, even happier to invite our panel here, a superb panel that will follow, that will be talking about tax policy and voting rights and how government can encourage active citizenship. So thanks again to everyone here today and to everyone joining us online. And before we get started, I want to thank a few of the people who made this possible. First of all, thanks to Daryl West, Emily Perkins, Letty Davalos, Louis Serino, and the Government Studies Program, and the whole team at Brookings. Special thanks to my former research assistant, who is now getting her PhD, Kirtlin Kramer, and my current research assistant, Jackson Godie, for their work. I would also like to thank Mark Mazur, Bill Gale, Lydia Austin, and everyone at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. And I want to specifically mention the organizations in Texas and Ohio that actually implemented our experiment. In Dallas, that was Foundation Communities and Faith in Texas. In Cleveland, Refund Ohio. And, of course, just enormous gratitude to the hundreds of VitaSite coordinators, intake specialists, voter registrars, and other tax preparation volunteers who made the project possible. The Analyst Institute assisted on the experimental design and analysis. And finally, a special thanks to the New Venture Fund's Research Collaborative Fund project for their financial support, and thanks also to the Arnold Foundation for supporting my work through the Tax Policy Center. Okay, now I get to tell you what all of this work achieved. As I said, the idea was a really simple one. When you file your income taxes, what if we asked you if you'd like to register to vote or update your voter registration? It seems like a very simple fix, and there are plenty of reasons to be optimistic about its impact, right? So first of all, 150 million households file their income tax returns every year, and it reaches an enormous number of citizens, and it reaches them annually, which could be really valuable in a highly mobile society like the one that we live in. It could also reach people who do not regularly go to the DMV, which is one of the other major ways that people get registered to vote. So that means people in cities, young people and older people, are all groups that could maybe be reached by a tax filing process more than going to the DMV. Also, voter registration compared to tax filing is a very marginal amount of paperwork, right? So there's, you know, they always talk about making the income tax return on a postcard. The voter registration form is actually a postcard. Right, so we add this tiny amount of additional paperwork, and maybe we can make a real difference in terms of people getting registered. And finally, what actually brought me to this project was a lot of work, including some of my own work, suggesting that in America, taxation and representation are really closely linked ideas. So Americans see taxpaying as evidence of being a good citizen, and so whether you're happy to be getting a refund, or you're mad about what government does, or you're glad to be paying for public services, when you're filing your income tax return, you're aware that government matters for your daily life, right? So maybe that makes the idea of voting more appealing. So this all sounds good, but obviously it's Brookings, so we would like there to be evidence. And so, you know, a lot of things sound good in principle. So what we did was conduct a large-scale field experiment in two states, in Texas and Ohio, testing how effective it would be to conduct voter registration at tax time. And we worked with nonprofit tax preparation sites that participate in a program called the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, right? This is a program that's nationwide. It serves 3.5 million households a year, and it allows low and moderate income families to file their income taxes for free. So we worked with two of the largest networks of VITA sites in the country, in Dallas and in Cleveland, to offer voter registration at their sites. So this approach, working with the VITA sites, has an added advantage in that it targets a community that tends to be underrepresented at the polls, low-income people. Right. So in 2016, about 74% of individuals making over $50,000 a year voted. Only 52% of those making less than $50,000 a year voted. So there's an enormous divide in voter turnout by income. So we thought that partnering with VITA sites would be a really great way to sort of target the project to the people who might need the voter registration services the most. And that work, that targeting work, the average income at our sites was $23,000 a year in Ohio and $27,000 a year in Texas. And because of the population of those two cities, we reached a heavily minority community as well. So in Ohio, 62% of participants were African American, and in Texas, 59% were Latinx. So working with VITA had the advantage of potentially reaching a much larger pool of unregistered potential voters, but it also may help make the voting population more representative of the public as a whole. So people come to our 7 VITA sites and are given the chance to get registered. But we didn't offer voter registration to everybody. And we didn't offer it to all 4,000 of our participants. We offered it to about half because we followed a principle, that sort of the basic principle of any sort of scientific experiment to test a new medicine, like a doctor would do, where we randomized, right? So half the people who came into the VITA site were randomly sorted into a group that got the treatment, which was voter registration, and half the group became our control group that did not, just receive tax prep services without the added component of voter registration. And I just want to talk very briefly about why we did it that way. By randomly offering voter registration to half the population and creating this treatment and control group, it means that we can see not only how many people did we register, right, we can see that, but how many people did we register who probably wouldn't have gotten registered otherwise, right? Because in our control group, the people who did not get registered through filer voter, some of them got registered to vote, right? They went to the DMV or they, you know, passed a table in front of a grocery store and they got registered to vote. So we want to know both, you know, how many people overall could you reach during this, but how many people could you reach who are not otherwise going to get registered, right? Because that's the sort of more stringent standard of an effective program. So that's how we conducted it. All right, and I've now delayed long enough. I'm going to tell you what happened. The results were really gratifying, honestly. Among people who were unregistered at the start of the experiment, we doubled the voter registration rate. Okay, I'm going to just say it again because it thrills me to say. We doubled the voter registration rate. Slightly under 4% of unregistered people in the control group registered to vote. Almost 9% of the people who were unregistered at the start who went through filer voter registered to vote, right? That's a 5 percentage point increase. And our effects were largest for people under 34. As you might imagine, young people are less likely to be registered to vote. So among the younger people in our experimental pool, we increased voter registration rates by 10 percentage points. So based on these effects, we actually think that if you did voter registration everywhere in the country at all the VITA sites, you'd register about 115,000 people to vote, including 62,000 people who would not otherwise get registered. And that's, you know, that's quite a bit. But VITA sites only reach 3.5 million households. I mean, that's a lot, right? But 150 million households actually file their taxes each year. So if you imagine what it would mean to add voter registration to the entire population, I think these effects could really be enormous. All right, so they registered, but did they vote? So we looked in Ohio at that question. In Ohio, the primary election was late enough that the people who registered through filer voter in the tax season were eligible to vote in that election. And we found that people who participated in filer voter voted at slightly higher rates than the state average, which is great. And it's especially great when you bear in mind that we're talking about a low-income population that typically turns out less, right? So they voted. They registered. They voted. And the last piece is sort of an implementation piece, but actually might be the most crucial piece in terms of expanding the program beyond an experimental setting. We measured whether getting asked about voter registration slowed down tax preparation, and it didn't. And that's really valuable, right? Because these nonprofit sites have more clients than they can possibly handle. They're always rushing to get as many people this incredibly important service, free tax preparation. They're trying to get everyone through the door. And so if you slow them down from their primary mission, that's really problematic. We did not find that that was a problem. And I think that could also be valuable for for-profit preparers who are also in the position of having to make money while filing people's taxes. But here, and I, you know, it's kind of obvious in a way because the voter registration form is very short. It takes a minute or two to fill out, right? So you can add that to the tax prep process without slowing down your other procedures and without moving energy away from your primary mission of tax preparation. All right. So I want to talk for just a minute about the policy implications of this, right? So this was an experiment. It reached 4,000 people. What does it mean if we wanted this to be a much larger program? I think the first thing to remember is that nonprofits who are interested in voter registration need to think about tax filing as a time when they can do that. In the voting community, I learned in the process of putting this research together, the voting community and the tax community does not overlap that much, and it really should for lots of reasons, but among them, any voter registration group in the country that wants to do a project partnering with a VITA site in their area, this is a project that works. You will make an impact, right? So I'd be more than happy to talk to anyone who works in voter registration or on tax prep about how this project was run in the sort of nitty-gritty details and try and make some of those connections so that this project could be in place much more broadly for 2020. Second, for-profit tax preparers should consider adding voter registration to the services they provide. Not all of you may know this, but the big companies like TurboTax or H&R Block, they do 20-plus million returns a year. So they could single-handedly vastly increase civic participation in this country by offering a service that takes only a minute or two. And a lot of big companies offer voter registration. Starbucks does that, so does Walmart. But I think the tax prep companies are in a really unusual position because they're actually helping you fill out forms that need to go to the government. So instead of, at Walmart where there's a table and you're trying to go by because you want to get your TV or what have you, like, this is a site where you'd have people. It's an unusual level of impact you could have, I think, by providing voter registration at tax prep. And then the last piece is the policy piece, of course, right? Connecting tax filing with existing efforts to move towards automatic voter registration, which a bunch of states are doing, could be really valuable, right? The most obvious approach, I think, would be to, for states or even the federal government, to add an opt-in voter registration bucket on tax forms, right? So when you're filling out your income tax forms, you've already got all your paperwork. You just check a few extra boxes, and you could be registered to vote. So that's my big picture hope for what this project could mean in the long term. And I want to talk to you just a little bit about why, before I bring up our superb panel, I want to talk for just a few minutes about why I think this project matters. Voting rights in this country are under enormous threat, right? We all know this. And I think they're under, it's certainly far from the first time in our country's history, but I think there's a renewed threat that's come in just in the last 10 years or so. 25 states have put in place new restrictions that make it harder for Americans to vote, and that's just since 2010. And, Stacey Abrams was here at Brookings just a few weeks ago, and what she said was that we're really at an inflection point on this issue. And I think that's right. I think we actually only have a few elections to make the decision of whether we're a country that considers the sanctity of the vote a serious issue, right, who actually thinks that all of our citizens deserve and should participate in the political process, or we can make the choice to follow the path of the worst part of our nation's history and exclude people from the political process, right? So we can either renew those politically exclusive traditions or we can move in the direction that I think we all like to imagine has been the long arc, right? So filer voter is clearly not the silver bullet for all of these issues. I don't think any policy could be, any single policy could be, but I think it's a meaningful component of an agenda of political inclusion and of democratic revitalization. Thank you, guys. I'm gonna welcome to the stage our panelists, Jessica Fulton, Chai-Ching Huang, and Jamila Michener, who are all experts on the intersection of public policy and civic engagement. And I should introduce you to Jessica, who's going to be the moderator for the session. Say, come on up, you guys. Up you come. Jessica is the Economic Policy Director of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, where she engages in research and analysis to identify policies that advance the socioeconomic status of the Black community. She also manages the Joint Center's Policy Incubator. Prior to joining the Joint Center, she served as the External Relations Director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and she held positions at the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute and the Chicago Urban League. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Vanessa. I'm going to wait for folks to get mic'd up before I start, but can you all give Vanessa a round of applause for her presentation? I'm really excited to be here today. I'm going to introduce the other panelists quickly and then tell you a little bit about why I was really excited when I learned about this project. And then I have some questions for them. We're going to talk for a bit and kind of go back and forth, and then we're going to open up to audience questions. So, start thinking about what you want to ask. Questions, not comments, preferred, the drill. Okay, so Chai-Ching Huang is the Director of Federal Fiscal Policy with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities Federal Fiscal Team, where she focuses on the fiscal and economic effects of federal tax and budget policy. Jamila Michener is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. Her research focuses on poverty, racial inequality, and public policy in the United States. Her recent book, Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics, examines how Medicaid, the nation's public health insurance program for people with low income, affects democratic citizenship. So a tax expert, a politics-y person, and both. So I'm really excited to be here because Vanessa's work really helps me to think through how we think about who gets to be a citizen in this country, right? Who gets to interact with our government? I think as a person who's a descendant of a community where we were literally written into the Constitution to not be full citizens in this nation, and as a person who interacts with the government very regularly and very intimately now, I think this is really interesting how we think about who gets to be an American. In Vanessa's book, Read My Lips, which you all should pick up, she talks about how taxpaying matters quite a bit for how people think about belonging to society. So I want to kind of turn to Chai Ching for the first question, since she knows a lot about taxes and who pays them. Over time, politicians have discounted lower-income Americans. They assert that they don't pay taxes. You think about Mitt Romney and the 47%. And because of that, maybe their voices don't matter as much as higher-income folks. Can you talk a little bit about the reality? Do poor people pay taxes?
So I think there's a factual part of this claim, and then there's a real moral judgment part of this claim. And I'll talk a little bit about the factual part. And really here I'm just repeating work by my friends I can see in the audience from the Tax Policy Center that look at the fact that if you count both federal income and payroll taxes, really more than three quarters of people pay federal taxes on net. And then, of course, you add in federal excise taxes, state and local taxes, fees that they may pay for other interactions with government. And on net, most people in a given year are net taxpayers. And then over time, that number increases further. So it really becomes factually misleading to try to, compartmentalize people into taxpayers and non-taxpayers, both, you know, in terms of the taxes people pay over time and the fact that their broader households that are outside their tax filing units and their broader communities that they may interact with, grandparents who are, you know, using Social Security or other family members that they may be supporting outside the tax unit, it's really not possible to divide people up that way. But, of course, I think, you know, the deeper sort of values question there is whether or not paying net federal income tax or net taxes overall is really something that should be something that determines whether or not your voice matters as a citizen. Because, of course, many of the people who pay no federal income tax in a year they have a really front row seat into the ways in which the economy is working and in many ways failing. They may be out of the workforce for a couple of years because of medical issues or unemployment, a factory closure. And do you want to be saying that that voice, that perspective on the economy is different or less valued? And that's something that obviously Vanessa has a lot to say about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really a critical question. One thing that I've been thinking about recently is that, you know, our tax system is decided by our laws, but the laws that govern our markets are also political decisions, right? So I think that sometimes we can privilege market outcomes that we actually know are, you know, fundamentally decided by laws that are not always, you know, ideal, right? And so we end up with enormous populations of people who are left with the impression, and I think are encouraged to feel, that their labor isn't valuable. And I think that says it's often a short way of saying that we don't think those people are valuable. And that's not a very democratic, small-d democratic way of thinking about the world. Obviously, citizenship shouldn't come with a price tag. Like, that just doesn't make any sense. We spent a really long time moving away from that model in this country, as has the rest of the world that involves itself in democratic practice. So that seems really clear to me. But one thing, there's this phenomenon sort of through American history of seeing taxpaying as a way that you can contribute to your society, right? Because, you know, taxes are, at the end of the day, the part of your labor that you contribute to the public good. And I think it's very reasonable to be proud of that. And so given that Americans feel this sentiment that taxpaying is one of the things you should do, it's part of your civic obligation, and it, with remarkable regularity will tell you that it's like voting, which is very strange because voting is not mandatory and taxpaying definitely is. But, you know, it's a sentiment that people hold that taxpaying is like voting and it's something you have to do for your community. We can tap into that sentiment. The problem is that this misperception about who pays, right? But I think that encouraging people to see their civic responsibility as something to be proud of is a fine sentiment, yeah.
So, Jamila, a lot of your work focuses on the interaction certain groups have with our government and with political institutions. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important to think about low-income people or other marginalized groups? And what do their lives look like? What is their interaction like day to day?
So, great question. One of the reasons why I have been excited about this project that I know has, you know, I've talked to Vanessa about in various ways over the years is because it represents an opportunity to provide a different kind of interface and interaction with the government than most low-income people are in fact getting, right? So there's no single story about the way that low-income people interact with the government, but there are sort of modal experiences, right? And we can gauge these in a variety of ways. And my work really focuses on both quantitative ways of looking at this through large surveys that where we can capture on in a sort of you know, broad way, what's happening with low-income people, and then qualitative. A lot of my time is spent just talking to people about their experiences. And one of the things that is easy to forget, unless you're thinking about people's lives and sort of the day-to-day experiences that they have, is that, you know, voting is probably the one of the most distant and from some vantage points, right? Least impactful set of interactions that low-income people have with the government and with the state, right? What's much more sort of meaningful and much more impactful in their lives could be that bureaucrat who's at the public assistance office who controls whether you can get access to healthcare benefits, whether you can get access to food and nutritional supplements, whether you can get access to cash that you may need to be able to survive on a day-to-day basis. The police officer who is patrolling your block, who can decide literally whether or not you live or die. And all of the other, you know, the child protective services person who can decide that you no longer deserve to have custody over your children. And all sorts of other figures who have control over where you live, what basic resources for survival you can have access over. And low-income people are not unaware that the kind of entity that determines their access to a lot of those resources is the government, right? And by and large, not in every single case, and it's important to sort of think about differentiation, but by and large, experiences with those different kinds of agencies and institutions are negative. And they reinforce a sense of powerlessness. They reinforce a sense of worthlessness, right? I can't count the number of ways that people have expressed these sort of sentiments to me. And so when there's a way that you interact with the government, which I think this is what sort of taxes represent, that reinforces your ability to make a contribution to the public good, and we can connect that way with your actual political engagement and participation, it is a kind of synergy and a bringing together of really important ways of thinking about your role in a polity, right? And right now, the state of affairs in the U.S. is that too many low-income people don't understand themselves to have a role in our political community that matters and is meaningful. And so as many pathways as we have to changing that, I think it's for the better.
So Vanessa, can you talk a little bit about that? About that, the opportunity that you saw between like having this happen right at tax time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's been some really interesting work done looking at what low-income people experience at tax time, right? And the thing that startled me when I was reading some of this research was that it is one, as you say, one of the more inclusive experiences, one of the better experiences of government for low-income people. And I think that says a lot about what the other experiences of low-income people have with the government. Because I had done these interviews where I would ask people, so explain what you think about the sort of tax paying and why do people pay taxes, and people would say something about the country or civic responsibility. I'd be like, oh, what are other responsibilities like that? And I was expecting that people would either say a military draft or jury duty, which are the responsibilities that are actually like taxpaying and that they are mandatory public service and take your time. You know, they're blood and treasure. It's the commitment we make to our polity. They said voting. Every time they would say voting. And I just thought it was so striking. So the idea that I had was,
if there is an opportunity, if there's a moment when low-income people are having an experience of government that is comparatively positive, and one of the ways that it's positive is that it often involves a tax credit, right? So, you know, a refund at the end of the year is a very positive experience, especially for low-income people who often rely on things like the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit to, for instance, pay winter heating bills that have mounted up or to pay off some debts or to put money away for their kids' schooling. These kinds of or purchase like a bigger ticket item, like a replace a broken washer or dryer, or get that part of your car fixed. Those sorts of things. The influx of money that comes in a refund is often one of the larger chunks of money that low-income people get to see during the year, so they can put it towards these expenses that are otherwise, I think, very difficult to cover. So, at that moment, I was like, why don't we use that moment to remind people and sort of actually encourage people and treat people with the sort of dignity they deserve, that, you know, you're citizens, this is one of the things you get to do is vote, right? And so that was my initial sort of impetus for the project. And then it occurred to me that it just made sense bureaucratically, right? Because tax filing is long and obnoxious. I'm in the Tax Policy Center, and I still think tax filing is like a long, obnoxious process. And why are we not taking that opportunity where you're already filling out paperwork to do one more thing, right? Yeah.
So, Chai-Ching, I want to touch on one thing that Vanessa mentioned about tax time for a lot of working class Americans being a time when they're able to get something back that that will help them in their lives. Can you talk a little bit about like what the tax experience is for people earning, but it's under $55,000, but like people that are going to these FIDA sites?
So a lot, again, as Vanessa mentioned, many low-income working families are eligible for the earned income tax credit and or the child tax credit, which are really the tax subsidies in the tax code that are best targeted towards working-class Americans. And, you know, many of them often receive that amount as a refund together with amounts that they've chosen to over-withhold. So when you were talking about getting money back, they've actually paid in more taxes deliberately often in order to maximise their refund. And it is really sort of very meaningful for day-to-day life. As Vanessa mentioned, a lot of the amounts we see going to things like groceries, heating bills, sort of regular expenses, school supplies. But then we're also seeing through a lot of the research that people often spend quite a lot of this amount towards things that Kathy Eden and others have called opportunity building types of investments. So paying down debt, saving up for a bigger ticket item such as, you know, a fridge so that they can buy groceries in bulk cheaper and save money across the year that way. Car repair, moving to a better apartment that has, you know, better quality of, you know, either closer access to a job or just sort of generally better heating or other environmental issues. So this is a really sort of important time of the year, and people often have thought ahead to how they're going to use that refund amount. So it is a real sort of focusing time where many of these VITA sites do use sort of tax time as a way to engage people with other resources that might be useful for some of that thinking ahead. So things like financial literacy, voting option is another sort of a thinking ahead type piece that goes into that. And what the research shows is that no matter how families use the refund, and they use it for diverse needs, you know, low-income people's lives and experiences are diverse and they have diverse needs, we're showing sort of growing amounts of research that shows that it really does make a difference, in particular for children and families that receive these income boosts. So from a range of things like lower infant mortality, higher birth weight, better health during childhood, better test scores throughout schooling, and even things like increased college enrollment, because there is a really interesting study that shows having that lump sum amount at a salient time of year, if you have a senior in high school and you're thinking about whether or not you can afford that first year of fees for school and expenses, it actually increases college enrollment. So there are a range of ways in which these refunds are really mattering, and I think, again, interestingly, mattering in ways that are sort of forward-looking for these families.
So, Jamila, there have been other ways that this country has tried to kind of increase participation, and I'm thinking particularly about the Motor Voter Program. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and who that works for? What are the challenges there?
Yeah, so the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, there are a number of different components to the National Voter Registration Act. There are different sections. The kind of impetus behind the NVRA, Motor Voter, was to kind of expand the electorate, right? There were these moments in the 70s and in particular in the 80s and toward the late 80s, early 90s, when it became clear that, as Vanessa mentioned in her introduction, fewer and fewer Americans were voting to the point that folks were sort of motivated to do something about it. And the idea was to sort of remove as many barriers as possible to voter registration and to create as many pathways, right? So not just removing barriers, but also create pathways to voter registration. And in particular, there was an awareness of who wasn't as likely to register to vote. And among that group were low-income Americans, right? So probably one of, for me, for my work, one of the sections of the NVRA that stand out the most is Section 7. And Section 7 essentially said, well, let's go to the places where we know low-income people are. And they may not be as likely to register to vote at the DMV, but we know that they'll be at public agencies, right? So they'll be in various spaces where they sign up for a public benefit. And in those agencies, let's give them an opportunity to register to vote. One of the things that happened in the wake of the initial passage of the NVRA is that compliance with the law, especially with Section 7, especially with that piece, that component that was most focused on expanding the electorate to incorporate low-income people, compliance just sort of dramatically dropped over time. And the drop in compliance varied a lot across states. One of the things that I look at in a paper that I published a few years ago was, well, what explains this? You know, what's going on, right? And part of what explains the compliance, I find, is what looks to be like a form of institutional racism, right? So in states where a larger component of the population and of the electorate is African American, we see less compliance with the law, right? And there are all sorts of other things that explain the ebb and flow of compliance, but the general direction has been towards less rather than more compliance. And there's been sort of intermittent enforcement of the NVRA that varies, for example, depending on who's in office, like the presidential administration, and varies also on levels of enforcement at the state level. And so we had this big moment where we kind of recommitted to expanding the electorate and creating more political equality, and it sort of culminated in this law that was supposed to change a lot, and kind of the responsibility of the states to enforce and comply with this law really fell through the cracks, and fell through the cracks in ways that systematically undermined the incorporation of particular sets of groups of Americans, right? And so our history isn't great. I think there are some things there are some useful lessons here, right? One of the things that I find especially promising about Voter Filer is that, you know, I appreciate that Vanessa laid out some ways that states or the federal government could be a part of the process, but there are also these other options for, you know, non-governmental entities to be involved. And so even if a particular state like Texas, for example, might not be super excited about getting people to register to vote, non-governmental entities can still take sort of the reins and try to make things happen without, you know, relying on what might be an otherwise hesitant or recalcitrant state to take action. And so there are some more possibilities there for which actors can be players in making these things happen.
You mentioned that different states may have different situations or different levels of compliance with this law. Vanessa, can you talk about the difference between Texas and Ohio? Like, what were there any challenges? Like, are there things that we could learn from this project?
Yeah, I can talk all day on this subject. So, one of the, you know, I'm a political scientist. I was broadly speaking familiar with the ways in which states had moved to make it harder for people to vote. But actually getting to experience them in the course of trying to run an experiment in two very different settings was eye-opening nonetheless. So there have been a set of rules put in place in Texas, but not in Ohio. And Ohio has its own voting issues. I'm not saying that Ohio has no voting issues. But a set of rules were put in place in Texas that did not exist in Ohio that their impact was to make it very hard to do a voter registration campaign. It was not especially hard to personally register to vote if you wanted to as an individual, but if what you wanted to do was register a lot of people to vote, it's really difficult. And I'm just going to talk about a few of the rules that were put in place. And I should be clear that I actually had to put a fair amount of effort into learning these rules. I had to talk to county commissioners about it. I had to talk to the state board of, I had to speak to a lot of officials to actually even understand how I could, within the law, conduct a voter registration campaign. And I have enormous resources at my disposal in terms of understanding the law, of being able to reach out to experts on these issues, right? If you're just an average person who wanted to run a voter registration campaign in Texas, you do not have those things available to you. But among the rules that we encountered were, one, two, if I wanted to collect a voter registration form from one of you, well, first, I can't because I'm not from Texas. Two, I would have to be an eligible voter. I don't technically have to have voted, but I have to myself be eligible to vote. So in an immigrant community, for instance, where there is a large population, particularly of older people who are perhaps not yet citizens, but their kids are all about to become citizens, or about whom voting age citizens, it becomes harder to run a voter registration campaign because if you aren't yourself eligible to vote, you cannot collect a voter registration form from someone else. You have to co-sign a special receipt for the voter registration form, which gives you the strong impression that you are validating the information, but you are a private citizen, so cannot in fact tell. Yeah, you cannot in fact judge whether someone in fact lives at that address, right? So there's a sort of chilling effect that I think occurs because of that. But even more important, in order to collect that voter registration form, it's not enough that I need to be an eligible voter in the state of Texas. I need to be deputized by the county. And that's a county-by-county deputation, and I believe there are 254 counties in Texas. So if I'm going to be sitting at a table collecting voter registration forms like you see on every college campus, you know, every election year, I need to have gone to a special training at the county office. Now, in a county like Dallas, the county office wants to help people get registered to vote. They cared a lot about it. You could get that training done, I think, every lunch hour and every day after work. Now, if you're in a county office and don't feel like encouraging voter registration campaigns, you could offer those trainings far less often, right? So you have to be deputized by the county. And then you have 5 days to submit the voter registration form by hand to the county office. That's 5 days, not 5 business days. So there was a point at which I and my research assistant were sitting in my office looking at a calendar of the spring, right, because tax season is the spring, and figuring out if we collected a voter registration form after 5 p.m. on a Thursday, how could we arrange a carpool situation to get those forms to the county office on Friday, because if the Monday sometimes offices are closed. So we had to do, you know, it was an enormously arduous process. The other piece where I really saw the effect of voter suppression in the course of doing the experiment was we then matched the names to the voter file, right? And if you were here a few weeks ago and heard Stacey Abrams speak about this or just followed the news, requiring an exact match of a name is a really good way to have names not match. Right, and I was sitting there with the goal of getting every name to match, and so I got to see that apostrophes are a problem. Oh, spaces are a problem. Alternate spellings of traditional names, because obviously you fill out a form by hand. Someone types it into a computer. If you have an unusual spelling of your name, you're just going to be more likely to be errors. And so what I got to see firsthand is what we know in the aggregate disenfranchises people of color, right, and people from immigrant communities, and so. The extent to which it was more difficult to conduct this experiment in Texas was really, I knew it going in, but I did not really know how much more difficult it was going to be. And it's actually one of the reasons I wanted to do it that way. I wanted us to do the experiment in a place where it would be hard. Because the point was not to make my experiment work, though that was great. the point was to test whether this would work in reality, right? So I can't just do voter registration in the place that voter registration is easy, where you have 10 days to submit a voter registration form by mail, and you know you can collect voter registration forms without going to the county and all those things, like Ohio. I could get my experiment to work there. But what I wanted to know was that my experiment, you could take it to Texas, that you could take it to somewhere like Florida, where they're making these rules more stringent, and actually expect to see a real effect in the real world. But yeah, Texas.
We're coming up on 2020, So things are happening. And in a couple of states, you talked about Stacey Abrams. Andrew Gillum, I know, is working on this in Florida. People are actively trying to make sure that more people are able to participate in our democracy. I have a question, I guess, for everyone on the panel. What would change, or why is this important? Like, what would change if we allowed more folks, in particular lower-income folks, to participate more fully?
You know, so what's funny, I was giving a presentation recently, and I was talking about expanding the electorate, and someone in the audience said, you know, I can think of some places where I don't necessarily want to expand the electorate, right? I can think of some places where if the electorate expanded, those people would be wanting policies that I don't want. So what do you think about that, right? And one of the things I said was, look, there is the kind of practical considerations that we all have based on our politics and maybe our partisanship or what have you. There are outcomes that we would like to see happen in our political world. And there are folks that we know, if those folks engage, those outcomes might be more likely to happen. And so that's one set of considerations. I think another set of considerations that's important to me, in addition, is, you know, the kind of quality, the sustainability, and the veracity of our democracy, which sounds really cheesy, and often I put democracy in scare quotes. So it's not to say that I don't have my own cynicism around democracy, in particular in the U.S. But it's what we have, and it could get better or get worse. And I suppose it could stay the same, but it seems like we're going to have to make a choice. Like, it will be one or the other. And so I think the best outcome is just that whatever the tangible material outcomes are, that they are more reflective of more people's voices being involved in the process. And so that's the, like, kind of top level, most important outcome, in my view. I also think that, like, evidence suggests that when the electorate expands, there are more voters who are Democratic voters. So that's just the practical reality of what happens. Although that varies in across place, right? So it's not the case necessarily that in Ohio or that in Wisconsin or that in rural areas across the country, an expanded electorate is just going to be a boon for Democrats. And so there's a way in which this has partisan overtones that are meaningful and we can't ignore. There's also a way in which that's not fundamentally what it's about.
Yeah, if I can follow up, though, I think that's exactly right. That it's certainly not the case that every place that you put a filer voter program would be a boon for Democrats. There are many places where that is certainly not the case. And I think that can get, you know, in the national rhetoric, can get kind of washed away. Or I think that sometimes Democrats imagine that just, you know, well, we'll make, you know, which is a fine idea to make Election Day a holiday, that this would automatically just involve winning forever. And I, you know, there are a lot of people in this country, and they have different opinions. You probably shouldn't put all your eggs in the basket. So I think, yeah, there's real variation by area. I mean, the other thing that is more of a long-term consideration is what people think about politics now when they're not enfranchised, and what they would think if they were actually asked to participate are different, right? Because, you know, like, you have an opinion about something, and then you actually have to make a decision, and you look into it, and you're like, oh, yeah, that knee-jerk thing that was easy to say when I actually had no authority to make any choices, and what I actually will do now are different. And that's what it means to be asked to be part of the polity, I think, at least in the broad scope, that it's not obvious to me that the politics, that the sort of, like, the political arrangement that exists now would simply be, like, expanded with more people on this end of the scale, right? I think it could work really very differently.
I'm going to sort of answer that one by asking questions of the people that know better. I think one thing that's sort of interesting that Jamila mentioned, and I think sort of comes up in the connection with voting and tax filing, is this idea that regardless of who you're expanding the polity to, whose preferences you're bringing in, there is an aspect of voting that is somewhat like a public good, and the fact that it increases overall trust that the political system is, democratically reflective of the preferences of a broader set of people, and that generates something about, it says something about the policies that come out of that process if you have more participation at the start, and you might want to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. The second sort of question or issue that I'll throw back to you is that there's also a lot of research that suggests that even when you have voters' preferences expressed, that they're not necessarily reflected on the outcomes of the political process because of a whole lot of other things. And I'm wondering whether you see sort of bringing more people into the process potentially likely to actually change some of that as well as what preferences are being expressed.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think, the kind of running caveat that underlies everything I ever say is that I'm sort of deeply pessimistic, so just, with a grain of salt, however large you think the grain should be. I do think there are representational issues that political scientists have, like, very adeptly identified, especially over the last, many years, but in particular over the last decade or so of research that suggests that, like, even if everyone came out to vote and we had a system that was equitable in terms of, the franchise, that the actual sort of output, at least policy output of the system, wouldn't necessarily be representative of those folks' preferences for a variety of reasons, including really compelling work that suggests that, for example, the political voice of the economically wealthy just carries more weight for a variety of reasons. So it's not that sort of expanding the electorate is a silver bullet solution to our problems with democracy, right? There are a lot of other ways that we should think about this. But there is some interesting research I came across recently that suggests that people who vote are also more likely to do some other things, right? They're also more likely to just pay attention to politics in general because now there's some buy-in or expected buy-in in the future, so you're paying more attention. They're also more likely to sort of consume various forms of political information and therefore to be knowledgeable about politics. And they're also more likely to participate in other forms of political engagement. And all of those things, I think, lend themselves to pushes that can help to ameliorate some of our representational issues, right? One of the reasons why it's possible for political elites to sort of not as much listen to middle class and lower class voters and listen to wealthy voters is because wealthy voters are super aware, super knowledgeable, they're holding you accountable. And even if they don't have the numbers, they therefore have the power, right? But if voting gets more people to behave the way that wealthy people vote, then it can change some of those representational dynamics, right? Without necessarily solving them, but change them in ways that are meaningful.
Vanessa?
I don't think I have anything to add. That was great. And I'm like the most optimistic. I'm like the total Pollyanna of this. But no, I think that's, one of the things that interests me in this work, and if I do more work along these lines, is to figure out, does reminding people to register to vote at tax time change their attitude about taxes? It could go the other way. I've been talking all about, the tax part, have your feelings about taxes and they'll influence your voting. It could easily be that now you've done your voter registration and now you're like, where is this money going? Or so you're like, you could imagine that there could be an effect in the other direction. And so that's actually a piece of what interests me is thinking about those questions about how the experience of being asked to register to vote maybe changes your interest going forward. The other piece that's much more on the ground practical is if we get people registered to vote in the spring, it means that they will be newly registered voters throughout the campaign season, which means that they are more likely to be contacted and encouraged to actually turn out later. In a way that can be valuable. Those repeated contacts kind of be like, oh, okay, now three or four people have asked me if I'm voting on election day, I should really get my act together kind of a thing. So I think that's a value of having a early in the year registration process.
More texts from various campaigns.
Everyone should suffer as we suffer.
Okay, I'm going to ask one final question. So if the audience has questions, please get ready. And it's basically just, what else would you like to say? Have we not covered anything that you think is important for us to talk about today?
I mean, I'll just say one thing that really stands out to me from having read the report and that came across in your comments, but I would just underscore, is the kind of equity dimensions of this, right? Is that even in Texas, in a place where there are lots of reasons to believe that there would be a chilling effect for a variety of reasons related to immigration, enforcement, et cetera, and where a lion's share of the people who were a part of the experiment were Latino, you still see increases, right? And in Ohio, where a disproportionate number of the experiment participants were African Americans, you see gains. And so this is about equity, both along the lines of class and along the lines of race. And I think that's a really crucial component. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a component we can miss sometimes when we think about get out the vote, right? That's not to say that we don't want to get everyone out to vote. But it is to say that I think there are some representational bonuses to bringing out the folks who are otherwise easily marginalized in the broader political system.
Just picking up on that, I think while the tax system and particularly FIDA sites, the ITC and CTC, are very well targeted to reach those groups at the moment, there are many ways in which they can be better at doing that. The EITC for so-called childless workers who are not claiming dependents in the home, for example, many of them are non-custodial parents, many of them have older children, for example, but they receive so little earned income tax credit that many of them are taxed into or deeper into poverty by the federal tax code. So fixing that would be an additional reason for many of these workers who are outside the tax system to come into it. The child tax credit at the moment, the changes, you might have heard about the recent tax law doubling it. Well, in fact, for the very lowest income working families, they get nothing close to that. About 11 million children are in families who got $75 or less. So, again, expanding the child tax credit, eventually making it fully refundable, would be a much more inclusive way to target that credit and would have some benefits in bringing more filers into the tax system over time.
Yeah, I think just the last thing I would say is that, you know, a lot of Jamila's work and a lot of Chai Ching's work, and this work sort of relates to it as well, is sort of thinking about public policy in terms of creating a more active citizenry. And I think sometimes we forget that. We're like, okay, well, we've transferred X dollars from here to here, and, you know, what are the economic implications and those sorts of things. But I think a way of thinking about our social safety net that I think is a valuable and sort of like a non-condescending approach to thinking about our social safety net would be to think about, okay, what do we need to give people so that they can be the citizens that we want them to be, right? And that requires providing people with a certain independence. And so this project, you know, on tax policy, maybe we can do this voting at tax time, but I think across economic policy, certainly, and probably even more broadly than that, we can think about policies in terms of their political effects and in terms of a commitment to democratic practice in keeping with the ideals of the country.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Kim Rubin from the Tax Policy Center, longtime VITA volunteer, and probably a pessimist on the stand. So I really like this in theory and the idea of it. What worries me, and I'd love to get some feedback on, do we think that given the political climate right now, there could be unintended consequences that are negative to things like VITA programs? Like, for example, if you think about the whole discussion over the census form and the fact that adding a question about citizenship would make it less likely for certain people to register. I'm just worried that if we start bringing up voting at VITA sites, especially VITA sites in Texas, either non-citizens would start getting worried about government touching them there and not go to those VITA sites, or losing support for VITA programs from the government because it's suddenly seen as more political than it was before.
Yeah. So I think there's twofold into that. We actually spent a lot of time working on that in Texas, right? Because the last thing I wanted to do, because undocumented in particular, I mean, people with green cards also pay taxes, but undocumented people file their income tax returns. And at the sites I was at in Dallas, there's a fairly large undocumented community. And in particular, some households have more than one citizenship status within the household. So you'll have one citizen and one undocumented person, and they're on the same forms. And so we were very concerned about the possibility that this would have a chilling effect on people filling out their income taxes, particularly at a time which was last spring, of really heightened immigration enforcement or attention to immigration enforcement, certainly, in addition to actually increased immigration enforcement. I worked really closely with the VITA sites on this question, and there were a couple of approaches we took to ensure, to sort of protect undocumented people, and I'd be happy to talk to the specifics of it. But the sites that are on the ground in those places felt they could do it. And that was, to me, the real standard, was making sure that people who are doing those day-to-day face-to-face interactions with communities that are, particularly in this political context, especially challenged, felt that they could do voter registration and they could do it in a way that was safe for their clients. More broadly, I mean, I think that they're, that if suffrage becomes so politicized that we cannot encourage it, I think that we are in a place beyond repair. So I think that the value of that commitment to universal suffrage is something that we cannot protect by failing to try and achieve.
Up here.
As a member of a nonprofit, the League of Women Voters, I wonder how you see a role we might have with tax preparers, and I'm curious what their objections might have been to registering voters, if you think there were viable ones or...
Oh, absolutely. So I think that people who work in VITA sites work really hard. Like, this is hard. You're doing people's taxes for free on a voluntary basis in your spare time. Truly, this is selfless. It's huge financial benefit to low-income people to do this work. So one of the reasons I was really concerned to make sure that voter registration itself did not lengthen the time it took to do tax prep was because the last thing that VITA volunteers need is another paperwork headache that they're dealing with, right? And I'll tell you that doing an experiment is actually an enormous paperwork headache, and bless the people of the VITA sites in Dallas and Cleveland for being willing to do it, right? Because there were consent forms and surveys, and they had to, send me copies of all these documents. It was a lot of work, right? Actually, just doing voter registration outside of an experimental context would be a breeze for anyone who can do their taxes. But there are specific ways that I suspect, and it would really be about connecting the voter registration group who wants to help with that piece to the VITA site and finding the way to make it work in their specific context, right? There are sites where it'll be more valuable than others. Obviously, sites with larger citizen populations will find that they get more voter registrations, right? Sites that are maybe on a college campus where the campus does voter registration anyway wouldn't be a valuable service there, right? So I think there are site-specific aspects of implementation, but the goal, and I would love to follow up with you about it, would be to connect local voter registration groups with VITA sites. And my experience of VITA sites across the country has been that a shortage of volunteers is the biggest problem. And I know the voter registration groups in this country have a lot of volunteers. So there may be ways that these groups can leverage one another to actually produce a really effective program locally. Yeah.
As an educator and school administrator for over 40 years, I don't hear a lot about education. I know the registration is complex, and it's a very important, crucial issue. But people need to know why it's important for them to vote. And feel that they're not disenfranchised. They go to a voting site once they are registered and feel comfortable with the process. And I think that's a big piece of it, too. I mean, we could make it available, and obviously it's complex, but if they don't have the interest and they're not advocating for themselves to actually do it and they're comfortable with the process, we could have it available, but people won't actually do it, or they may register but not see the value in actually voting. So what are we doing in terms of educating people?
I think I might throw that open to the group. It's supposed to be just...
Yeah, I think this is a great question. I think it's one of the reasons why there's no one single approach that solves everything, right? So there are different... The nature of barriers to voting are varied, right? And so one barrier is really about, access. It's just, I forgot to register. I didn't have the time to register. I don't know how to register. And given that opportunity... I will be registered and then I will vote, right? And there aren't any kind of knowledge problems in terms of understanding how the system works or even or interest, you know, a lack of interest or efficacy, not really believing either that you have the ability to make a decision about your political choice that is sensible, or not believing that even if you make that choice, it will have any effect, right? And so this tackles like one aspect of a kind of structural barrier. The question of some of those other, what I think of as like engagement level variables, like will people have interest? Will they have efficacy? Will they actually do this even once the institutional barriers are removed? I think that opens up a whole different kind of space, right? I think education is a component of that space. There's a really interesting study that was published late last year in December of 2018 by a couple of political scientists who showed that experiences, for example, more so, for example, than civics courses, your actual experiences with authoritarian relations in school affect how and whether you engage politically over the long haul of your life, right? And so, you know, on a day-to-day basis within institutions like educational institutions, within institutions like political institutions of various sorts, I'm working on a project now that looks at civil legal institutions, and people are having experiences in civil courts when they are being evicted or when their children are being taken away or what have you, that are completely demobilizing, right? And so there are these other institutional spaces where the efficacy and engagement issues have to be addressed. And I think that's, you know, we can think about ways to connect that to this, but I think that they're sort of different spaces. And I think we need to be able to have both in view at the same time, because it's really a both and not an either or. So it's important to ask this question and to think about the issue.
Up here. Right here.
Hi, I'm old retired guy. Thinking about all of this, so in today's world of big data and all of this thing, everyone who was a citizen of the United States who was born here, there was a record of their birth. Anyone who immigrates to this country and becomes a citizen, there's a record of them becoming a citizen. So why do we have voters registration at all when we already know who all of the people are? And simply me showing up and saying, I'm Dalton Williams and I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and then a few clicks of a keystroke verifying that, do we even worry about voters registration? And by doing away with that, do we make it easier for people to vote so we don't have this nonsense that went on in Georgia and these other places this election, and everybody can vote, and then we really have a democracy?
Yeah, I think, yeah, no, definitely. So we were talking about this beforehand. I don't think anyone from first principles would create our voter registration system. They would also not create our tax code. These are bubbled systems. And so this solution is a solution for this time and this, like, this political moment and this time in our history where a series of decisions have been made that we would have chosen differently otherwise. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that there are any number of simplifications and improvements, but given that particularly because I think we're at this inflection point in elections in this country, like, we need to be able to protect our democratic institutions in the immediate few years, and then maybe we can do this, right, this approach. And that would, you know, the long-term goal would certainly not be to combine two overly arcane processes into one slightly simpler process. Yeah.
I think it's worth sort of thinking both about how to address the immediate problem in front of our face and also how to build and lay the groundwork for broader system-level transformation, you know. The system-level transformation is really hard to think about right now when it feels like even very simple things are hard to make happen on a large scale in many places throughout the country. But, I mean, the appeal to logic is welcome.
Any more questions? Yes. There. Either way.
Thank you. Yes, picking up on that a little bit, I mean, one of the issues is our federal system, and even national elections are administered by states with all sorts of different rules. So getting to that logic is really, really hard. Are there other sort of things happening at other states related to this that you're encouraged by, or alternatively you're not so happy with?
So I think in broad strokes, there are a number of states that are moving towards an automatic voter registration system, which is, again, veering in the direction of logic. And that's really encouraging. Illinois, Connecticut, Washington State, a bunch of states, or California, have all sort of moved in that direction. I think that's extremely valuable. And I think that there could be a piece for this within that framework, right? That when government agencies are thinking about, because you have to, it's also where you live. So, you know, when you're encountering these different agencies and there's a sort of an opt-out rather than an opt-in procedure to get people updated on the voter rolls, the tax bureaucracy is one of those agencies that I think should be a player in all of those discussions. And sort of as Jamila was suggesting, for the states that have, at least in recent years, committed to moving in the opposite direction, I think that there's a serious space for nonprofits and for-profit taxpayers both to maybe step into that breach and provide the services that we would prefer to see, universally the case across all the states. But I'd love to hear more from you about the...
Yeah, so it's interesting. When I try to see if there's some sort of optimistic picture I can squeeze out of this somehow, maybe I'm biased, but one of the things that I think about is it connects back to what you said around big data, right? And big data really cuts in a number of ways. And one of the ways that it cuts is that even in the context of various forms of, like, electoral retrenchment, it provides us in the longer run with leverage for identifying the effects of some of the policies that strike us as more problematic, right? And so I think we're starting to see, and we'll see more and more going forward, more transparency and clarity around what the effects of policies that are undermining the electorate are. And I think that will just create additional barriers for implementing those kinds of policies, and it also create additional sort of fodder for opposing them. And so that's one way that I think big data can equip us with the kind of tools that we need to at least kind of, I think, erect an opposition to those who are inclined to continue to erode and undermine voting rights.
And I think in terms of using the tax filing apparatus, worth keeping in mind that, of course, there's precedent for the line on the form asking whether you want to contribute to the presidential election fund. So it's not the only place mm-hmm. on your tax filing forms that you encounter this idea of electoral process. So mm-hmm. it's not necessarily a huge lift for states to sort of co-opt some of that framework to do some of that work that you're talking about.
Vanessa, I'm curious, was there a way for you to identify if perhaps the people who were registering or doing these, going to get their taxes in were returning citizens? So, like, how do we think about people who have actually had their rights taken away that may not be included in this universal, right?
Yeah, so this is something I looked into because I knew the percentage of people unregistered people in Texas who would register would be lower because many unregistered people in Texas can't register because they're non-citizens. But a second concern I had was this, question of returning citizens. And in Ohio, actually had less stringent rules on this as well. That is to say, your voting rights are easier to reobtain after incarceration. But I couldn't see it in my data. But I think that it is perfectly plausible avenue that could help, particularly for states that re-expand voting rights to formerly incarcerated people. Often the hurdle is that they have to re-register, so you have to, put all of the sort of systems in place to make that occur, particularly for a population that has just been told about as firmly as possible that the state is not on your side, right? So I think that it could be a part of those processes for sure, yeah.
There was a question back here.
So I was just wondering if there were any other, like, government functions that people associate, with a positive experience of their citizenship that, like, voter registration could also become a part of.
Do you want to you want to jump in?
Yeah, that's a hard one. A hard one, of course, from one of my students at Cornell. Next class you take with me, I'm going to remember this. I'm only joking. That's not how I work. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I've been working on a project together with a colleague of mine at Duke University, Carolyn Barnes, and we've been trying to think about whether there's any sort of, or what heterogeneity looks like, because there's this overarching story of, well, basically for poor people, the government is doing, is creating a lot of demobilizing experiences. And we try to think about, like, but that's not always true, right? When is it true and when is it not true? And so we've really been thinking sort of program by program, policy by policy, where are these opportunities? And there are a number of places that we have identified and a few that other political scientists have as well. So, for example, we've been doing some research looking into the WIC program, Women, Infant, and Children's. And what we found is that, like, unlike most other means-tested programs, there's actually a boost in political participation for people who participate in WIC. One of the reasons that we suspect is the design of the program. It's very much about sort of actually engaging mothers because the goal is to improve their nutrition and health and their children's nutrition and health. So there's an informational component. There's a way in which they are interacted with dignity as though they're people. And it turns out when the government does that, there's a lot of possibility for good happening, right? Similarly, a lot of childcare programs, we've been finding that a variety of after-school programs, my colleague Carolyn Barnes actually does this great work where she looks at these government-subsidized after-school programs and the possibilities that they hold for teaching both, in particular, the parents who rely on these programs in order for their children to have childcare, teaching them political skills that they can then deploy in their lives, right? Both on a kind of local level and more broadly. So it's certainly the case that there are sites of possibility, right? But those are fewer and far between than we might otherwise like them to be.
I also think it's just important to remember the sort of potential for a virtuous cycle that we talked about before, and to remember that these settings are policy choices. Mm-hmm. These settings of these experiences that have been designed to be negative and demobilizing are often intended to be that way. Mm-hmm. And potentially if we attack it at some point in this cycle of policy making and experience of government, create a process by which the policy outcomes are more reflective of preferences and are not being set up to be sort of deliberately punitive, we might end up in a better place. And I think, attacking this question from lots of different places in the cycle is a good answer to my previous question and to this one as well. And that also gets back to the heterogeneity across programs, across states. There are some states that are doing better than others in terms of your experience of signing up for healthcare, being able to access the care and affordable insurance that you're eligible for, your experience in doing that, and some states are trying not to make it easy.
And this is my chance to plug the fact that I have written an entire book about Medicaid and federalism and political participation, right? How state variation in terms of the design and the administration of programs like Medicaid has implications that we can directly connect to various forms of political engagement.
Yeah, if I can just build on that, everyone should read the book. Yours too. Read all the books. I think that one of the things that can feel counterintuitive is that when we're talking about different programs that direct economic resources, they don't have the same effect, right? Like on a very basic level. And if we look at the programs that are available to middle-class people and historically, so things like Social Security or like the GI Bill directed enormous amounts of resources, help build and maintain a middle class in this country. So it's certainly the case that government can do things that are extremely bureaucratic, that enormous government systems that have a direct impact on people's lives, and you have to go and get benefits, you have to fill out paperwork, and it has an enormous mobilizing effect, right?
Yeah.
So we often fail to do that in means-tested programs,
yeah.
but it's certainly the case that government can provide those kinds of benefits when they so choose. Yeah.
Absolutely.
back here and then up here for two. So, sorry.
So I think it's Kathy Eden's work that shows that people who really depend on the EITC want to pay for their tax preparation because they think that the service they're getting is better or in some cases can get their refund faster. And I was just wondering how you think we could incentivize those for-profit taxpayers to use this sort of registration system, this voter registration system, so that we could amplify the impact.
Yeah, this is the question I have that I'm going to spend the next several months trying to answer. How do I convince, a TurboTax or an H&R Block that this is a good thing to do? It is obviously a very good thing to do, H&R Block and TurboTax. look, I think that I think there are a couple things. One, if your entire business model is dealing with people when they're doing something that irritates them, why not add something that everyone sort of gets to feel a little bit good about? I mean, this is a thing that I think it would be relatively easy to demonstrate, makes your clients happy. It is not an enormous additional lift. It does not cost you extra money, which is a big point. Which is the reason I measured how long it took people to do taxes is because, very reasonably, if you own a local H&R Block franchise, and this is going to take an extra 10 minutes for every tax return you do, that's actually going to hurt your, income, right? So those were some of the considerations I have in mind. I think that to some extent, it's reasonable to think that major companies in the United States play such an enormous role in providing social benefits, right? That our healthcare system works largely as an employer-based system. And that, if you're a company that wants to demonstrate your concern for the sort of dignity and respect that should be paid to your clients, then I think offering the opportunity to register to vote is a pretty good idea. It also doesn't take long and is very cheap. Please do it. Thank you.
Right here.
At League of Women Voters have had a little bit of success with some pilot programs in other areas, and I was wondering, is there a pilot program available for this to maybe advocate for? I like the incrementalism of pilot programs.
That's a good idea. So in a real sense, this was a pilot program, right? This experiment that I conducted was the first pilot of something that I would love to be taken up more broadly. I think, as with all experimental work, it is very worthwhile to do more than once, right, to replicate your findings. So yes, I am personally working on now making sure that we can do this again in 2020. So I would be very happy to talk to you about it individually. And I think it also, conducting the experiment again would be valuable for a lot of reasons. One, just because more people would experience it. Two, we could, experimental procedures are difficult and tax forms are difficult and tax filing is difficult, and we could make the process even more seamless. So I think that there's real room to try this again. And also each time you do it, now I can. The reason I did it was that I could go to people and say, "Hey, it worked," and doing it again, I think we just build that momentum. So yes, definitely.
One of the things that the League of Women Voters has definitely learned is that to register a voter is not necessarily to have that person vote. And so I know that wasn't part of your experiment, but I wonder if you came across anything coincidentally that you could suggest as to how to get registered voters to the polls.
Yeah, so I did look at turnout for Ohio, where the primary election was late enough that the people who registered through my program could then vote, and I would also be able to produce the results, in a reasonable period of time. And it did work, right? So people in Ohio who registered to vote through Filer Voter voted at rates slightly higher than the state average. So I think that that is very promising. I think certainly much more could be done in that regard, and there are enormous number of political science experiments that have been conducted about how to, for registered voters, move them to turnout. Right, and I think that one of the sort of obvious things that I have considered, if I did another pilot version, would be to have people fill out a postcard that would be then mailed to them, reminding them to vote. They just fill that out themselves, and then the the tax prep nonprofit or for-profit holds onto those, drops them in the mail in October, and you got a personal reminder from yourself to get to the polls. And it apparently is quite effective. And I'm sure that there are subtleties and more detailed ways of thinking about this work that could improve upon those kinds of moves. But I think that it's a big component of what I would like to see in future iterations.
Yep.
Just quickly going off of one of the earlier questions, as you're looking at expanding the program into other states, have you thought about dealing with the process of voter purging and how you interact with low-income individuals who don't know that they're no longer registered to vote?
So this was a challenge we faced in Ohio, which has done some of those voter purges. The way we dealt with it was to, if you weren't sure, re-register. That's not a perfect solution. One, because you can annoy your county clerks quite a lot. And you don't want to do that. They're very hardworking people. And, you know, having to have to go through a bunch of basically unnecessary voter registration forms is like a mistake. But I think that, at least in this case, when it was not yet obvious, and I don't know that it's obvious to anyone exactly what the impact of the purges in a given state are, you know, you sort of err on the side of caution with it. But, yeah, I think that that's – but I think there's also – there's something you have to weigh, right? Because there's probably what you would know. The more people know about the barriers to voting, I worry that at a certain point you could discourage people, right? So, like, you have to be – there's a really, like, a narrow road to sort of walk on this question.
Yeah. So I thought for a second, like, well, you could just say to people, Ohio has done a whole bunch of vote purging, like, you should really probably re-register just to be sure. But then there are two problems. One is that a lot of people having duplicate registrations, but also that – the kind of the potential for self-undermining, like, rhetoric where people hear that the state is trying to stop you from voting, and then it's like, oh, I guess I'm not going to vote, right? So it's a little bit tricky.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have time for one more question, I think, so maybe two. We'll see.
I'm just curious about what you mentioned about how filling out the voter registration form is very easy, and then you also mentioned that you could sort of move to a system where you just have an opt-in checkbox or an opt-out checkbox. Did your research show maybe what additional effect it would have had if people wouldn't have to rewrite their name and address and date of birth and all those annoying things that they already put on their tax form?
So my research does not show that, and in fact, because it was an experiment, they had to fill out a consent form too. So I think, you know, like the poor people. So I think that there are many things about the experimental setting that actually, like, tamp down what would be the findings if it were a more natural process. Canada actually does this. Canada does offer you opt-in voter registration on their income tax form. So it certainly can be done. As you pointed out, some states, there's the federal contribution for elections, and some states have, you can contribute to the wildlife fund, you can direct $3 if you're thinking, you know, those sorts of things. So I think there's room for this. The issue that I know to exist is the possibility that you need to have your residential address for voting purposes, and it's conceivable that you have, you know, a P.O. box where you want your refund sent, so it's possible you'd need two lines no matter what. But maximizing the efficiency of that process would be a next step for sure.
And there was one more? No? Okay. I think we can wrap up. Does anybody have any final thoughts they'd like to? Okay, thank you so much for having us all here. Thanks, y'all, for coming.